Welcome to the HN Pod, your quick, well, hopefully quick and insightful trip through the top stories on Hacker News. It's Saturday, May 17th, 2025, and this is episode 37.
37 already, wow.
Yeah, time flies. Today we've got quite a mix, five articles that really show the range you get on HNF.
Absolutely. We're going to dive into, let's see, a coding technique, push ifs up and fours down.
Right.
Then some new JavaScript stuff, explicit resource management.
Oh, yeah, that looked interesting.
And Proton potentially leaving Switzerland over a surveillance law.
Hmm, that's a big one.
Then something lighter, N64 graphics tricks, palette lighting.
Cool.
And finally, a Linux kernel dev trying out Home Assistant. So quite the spread.
Okay, let's kick things off with that first one. Push ifs up and fours down.
Right.
It sounds a bit, you know, abstract.
Yeah.
But the basic idea seems pretty logical.
Yeah, it's about how you process collections, like lists of items.
Instead of looping through item by item, checking a condition, then doing something, you sort of group the items first based on the condition.
Exactly. You figure out what needs doing for different types of items, and then you process those groups separately. Push the if check up out of the loop, then push the actual work, the for loop, down into separate batches.
And the main benefit is performance.
Yeah, that's the big headline. Performance improvements, sometimes quite significant ones.
How does that work exactly?
Well, think about that. If check inside a tight loop, you're evaluating it over and over, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you move it outside, you evaluate it maybe once for a whole batch. That saves computation. Plus, you amortize any setup costs for the operation across the whole batch.
Ah, okay. The article had that example with polynomial multiplication using FFTs.
Right. Fast Fourier transforms. That was a neat illustration. Evaluating polynomials at many points. Doing it in batches, apparently, gives a surprising speed up compared to one by one. It's not immediately obvious, but it shows the power of batching.
And it also helps the processor, right? Removing branches.
Exactly. Modern CPUs love straight line code. They hate branches, those if statements, because they have to guess which way the code will go.
And if they guess wrong,
they stall. Wasted cycles. By separating the logic, you create these nice, clean loops without branches inside. That makes the processor happy.
And that opens the door for vectorization.
Precisely. Vectorization, or SIMD instructions, single instruction, multiple data. The processor can do the same math operation on, like, 4 or 8 pieces of data all at once.
Kind of like processing a whole row in a spreadsheet instantly.
That's a good analogy. But it only works well if the data is laid out nicely and the operations are uniform. Batching based on conditions helps create those uniform streams.
They mentioned Tiger Beetle using this idea.
Yeah, at a higher level, architecturally. Batching database operations for efficiency. It's the same core principle.
It's not just speed, though. The article touched on expressiveness, making code clearer.
Right. Think about jQuery back in the day. It worked on collections of elements. Select all the buttons, then make them blue. It's a different way of thinking than find button one, make it blue. Find button two, make it blue.
More declarative, maybe.
Sort of. Like thinking in terms of sets and operations, like vector spaces almost. It can lead to cleaner code sometimes.
Okay, interesting stuff. Let's switch gears. Article 2. JavaScript's new superpower, explicit resource management.
Yeah, this looks like a genuinely useful addition to the language.
For anyone who's wrestled with, like, making sure files get closed or network connections are cleaned up properly in JS.
Especially with async await everywhere now, it can get messy.
So what's the new superpower?
It's a proposal introducing a using declaration, similar to what C# has, or Python's with statement.
Oh, okay.
And it works with new symbols. Symbol.dispose for synchronous cleanup and symbol.asyncdispose for, well, async cleanup.
So you declare a resource with using, and it automatically gets cleaned up when you exit that block, yeah. Even if there's an error.
That's the idea. It's meant to replace or at least simplify the common try, finally pattern we use now for cleanup.
Which can get pretty verbose, especially if you have multiple resources.
Right. And they've thought of that. They're also proposing disposable stack and async disposable stack.
Zax. So you can push multiple resources onto them.
Yeah, you can adopt resources onto the stack. And when the stack itself is disposed, because it's using block ends, it disposes of everything on it in the reverse order they were added.
Hmm. That sounds quite handy. The example they gave, using disposer, new disposable stack, const resource, disposer.adopt.
Yeah, it looks much cleaner than nested try finally blocks.
And it seems like this is a solved problem in other languages, right? You mentioned C#, Python.
And Java's try with resources.
Yep.
JavaScript is kind of catching up here, but it's a welcome catch-up.
Is there any controversy around it?
Well, some discussion. The whole what color is your function thing comes up because you have separate sync and async disposal methods. It reinforces that split.
Ah, the async versus sync divide.
Exactly. And some people quibble about the keyword using itself, feeling it's maybe a bit vague compared to other JS keywords. Minor stuff, mostly.
Can't use it yet.
It's a TC39 proposal, still moving through the stages. But Bun, the JavaScript runtime, has apparently already implemented it.
Oh, cool. So it's likely coming. Any chance of polyfills for older browsers?
That's being discussed, too. It seems possible. There was also a mention of maybe using defer like Go does, but using seems to be the direction they're taking.
Okay, so this could make JavaScript code, especially for servers or long-running web apps, more reliable. Less resource leaks.
Definitely. Better resource hygiene automatically. That's a good thing.
All right. Topic three takes us to Switzerland. Proton threatens to quit Switzerland over new surveillance law.
Yeah, this is a significant development.
Right.
Proton, known for its encrypted email and VPN.
Built on privacy, headquartered in Switzerland because of its privacy reputation.
Exactly. And now they're saying a new surveillance law, there is a major violation of the right to privacy.
What's the core issue?
Proton's whole model is minimal data collection. They argue this new law would force them to retain user data in ways that contradict that principle, undermining their promise to users.
But the Swiss authorities disagree.
Apparently. The article mentions a government official claiming the law just clarifies existing requirements, doesn't tighten them. Proton clearly doesn't see it that way.
If Proton actually leaves, that would be a huge blow to Switzerland's image, wouldn't it?
You think so? Attracting privacy-focused tech companies has been part of their brand. Losing a major player like Proton could definitely raise questions internationally.
It feels like part of a bigger trend, though. Governments wanting more access, encryption being a target.
For sure. We see similar debates elsewhere. The article mentions Norway and Denmark looking at data retention or surveillance laws, too. It's an ongoing tension.
The comments on HN brought up some practical points, too, like how secure is Proton mail if you're emailing someone on Gmail?
That's always the challenge with end-to-end encryption, right? It needs both ends. Communication between Proton users is encrypted end-to-end to a Gmail user, not fully.
But using Proton still protects your side more than using Gmail itself, I guess.
Absolutely. Your stored emails, your metadata visibility to your provider, it's still a significant privacy gain compared to services that scan your email content.
How does Proton work without storing stuff? People were asking that too.
Well, the content encryption happens client-side. Proton stores the encrypted blob, but they don't have the keys to decrypt it. That's the core idea.
Do they log anything? IPs.
Their policy mentions temporary IP logs for abuse prevention, which is pretty standard, and optional authentication logs if the user turns that on, but not permanent content or metadata logs by default.
Okay. Now, inevitably, the comments get into the Proton CEO's politics.
Yeah, that came up. As usual with these discussions, there were claims and counterclaims, but nothing really concrete presented in the thread, just speculation. We should probably stick to the verifiable facts of the situation.
Agreed. And the point someone made about not undermining privacy for everyone, just because bad actors might use the tools.
That's a fundamental argument in this whole debate, isn't it? Should tools be weakened for everyone because of potential misuse by a few?
So this whole situation is definitely one to watch. It has big implications for Proton, for Switzerland, and maybe for online privacy more broadly.
Definitely. Okay, let's shift gears again. Something completely different. Palette lighting tricks on the Nintendo 64.
Ah, retro tech. I love seeing this stuff. So advanced lighting on the N64.
Yeah, using palette manipulation in clever ways to simulate more complex lighting than you'd expect from the hardware.
The results looked pretty impressive. People were comparing it to, like, ICO on the PS2.
Which is high praise, considering the PS2 was a whole generation ahead and much more powerful.
Are these techniques things developers used back in the day?
Not necessarily. That's the cool part. A lot of this seems to be recent discoveries by the N64 homebrew and modding community.
Ah, like the work on decompiling Mario 64 and getting it to run at 30 FPS.
Exactly. That whole scene is uncovering new ways to push the hardware decades later. It's amazing.
So what's the technical trick here? Something about the N64's graphics chip, the RCP.
Right, the reality coprocessor. The commons dug into this. Apparently, the RCP was semi-programmable in ways that the graphics hardware in, say, SGI workstations of the time wasn't.
SGI.
Yeah.
They designed the N64 graphics, didn't they?
They did. But the N64's RCP could apparently do things in a single rendering pass, like certain blending or lighting effects, that required multiple passes on the SGI machines with their fixed function pipelines.
So it was kind of an early step towards modern programmable shaders.
In a very limited way, yeah. It gave developers a bit more flexibility than just configuring a fixed set of options.
But the programming tools were based on SGI's experience. OpenGL.
Yeah, the APIs were apparently quite good for the time, influenced by SGI's IrisGL and OpenGL, probably better than what the PlayStation or Saturn offered initially.
It's always fascinating how developers squeezed so much out of that hardware. Like the PS2 later, you mentioned it had a fixed pipeline, but amazing blending.
Right. Different strengths, different tricks. It really highlights the ingenuity required back then. You couldn't just throw more polygons at a problem. You had to be clever.
The original post asked, is this the future? Meaning like, the future of retro gaming is finding new ways to use old hardware.
Yeah, I think that was the gist. What else can these old machines do that we haven't discovered yet? It's a cool thought.
Okay, last article. A kernel developer plays with Home Assistant.
Right, a deep dive into the open source smart home platform from someone who really understands low-level systems.
Home Assistant, for people who don't know, is the big open source option focused on local control. Privacy.
And it's now run by a nonprofit, the Open Home Foundation, also in Switzerland, interestingly, funded by users, no VCs.
So what was the kernel dev's experience getting started?
It seems the core setup involves finding and setting up integrations for your devices, basically drivers.
Right.
Some are built in, but many more are in the Home Assistant Community Store, HACS, which requires a GitHub account to use fully, apparently.
Hmm. Okay. Were the integrations reliable?
Mostly, it seems, but the author did run into an issue with one specific integration for an open sprinkler device. It caused some problems.
So variable quality, kind of like...
Like Linux drivers 25 years ago was the author's analogy. Lots of stuff works, often thanks to the community, sometimes despite the vendors.
Makes sense. What are the basic concepts in Home Assistant?
You've got devices, the physical things, sensors, things that report status, like temperature, and controls things you can change, like lights or switches.
Seems logical. Was the overall impression positive?
Yeah, generally. The founder and community members chimed in positively in the comments, highlighting the local control and privacy aspects. Plus, there are open source mobile apps.
But there's a learning curve, right? People often say it's by IT people for IT people.
That definitely came up in the comments, too. It's powerful, but maybe not the most user-friendly entry point for non-technical folks, at least initially.
How do you actually run it on a Pi?
You can. There's Home Assistant OS, which is like a dedicated appliance image, or you can run it in Docker or a VM, different options with different trade-offs.
There was some discussion about supervised mode in Docker.
Yeah, apparently it's not the recommended way, but it lets you run other Docker containers on the same machine easily, which some people want. The official stance prefers the dedicated OS or container install.
Does it handle backups well?
Seems so. Backup and restore functionality is there, including encrypted backups, which is good.
Any mention of alternatives?
Yeah.
Like OpenHAB?
Briefly mentioned, yeah. There are other players in the open source smart home space.
The comments also touched on just how messy the whole IoT world is, right?
Yeah.
Every vendor with their own cloud.
Totally. And the challenge of making things from different companies talk to each other, that's a big part of Home Assistant's appeal, trying to bridge those gaps locally.
But users who get into it seem to love the flexibility and power.
Oh, yeah. The customization potential is huge if you're willing to learn it. Someone mentioned Debian is even working on packaging it.
So the takeaway is powerful, open, local, private, but maybe requires some tinkering.
That seems like a fair summary. A solid alternative if you want to avoid being locked into vendor ecosystems and cloud dependencies.
Wow. Okay. So we went from code optimization details to JavaScript evolution, then digital privacy battles, N64 nostalgia, and finally open source home automation.
Quite the journey through the Hacker News front page. It really shows the breadth of what gets discussed there.
It does. And you see these threads connecting them, like the tension between complexity and usability, or openness versus proprietary systems, or just the sheer ingenuity people apply to technology.
Absolutely. It makes you wonder, as we rely more and more on complex systems, whether they're built by big companies or open communities, how much control do we really understand we have? Or perhaps how much control are we willing to give up for convenience?
That's a good question to leave people with. Definitely check out the articles and the discussions on HEN if any of these topics sparked your interest. There's always more depth there.
For sure.
Thanks for joining us for this deep dive.